proudest and hardest thing I've ever done was Pope Joan. The one thing that both Ben and I wanted from Pope Joan was we didn't want it to be the high end of coffee. We didn't want it to be the high end of food. We wanted it just to be like Ian Botham, like the best all-rounder.
This is the Deep in the Weeds podcast. I'm Anthony Huckstep. Perhaps the most beautiful feature of a career in hospitality is the ability to travel and find work anywhere on the planet. The ability to adapt and learn new techniques, discover new ingredients, new wines, new ways, and evolve your knowledge. This is also a way to describe the evolution of Australia's culinary landscape. People from all walks of life, all places on earth, weaving a web of creativity and discovering something new within it. Matt Wilkinson is a culinary director of Montalto Winery and creative director of Made from Gin by Four Pillars Gin. Matt, that's quite a mouthful. You're pretty busy.
Yeah. Well, I'm working on a couple of other things as well. I've still got the pie shop at the moment, so it's life's a bit busy.
Well, you came from the UK to Australia quite some time ago and made a pretty big impact from a culinary perspective. What made you leave the UK to come to Australia?
So a bit of my background, I guess I grew up in a pub. Well, my mum and dad divorced when I was young, and my dad actually worked for Foster's UK. He was like the Northern England area manager, during the Hogan years when Foster's was the number one selling lager. No one drank it in bloody Australia, but everybody drank it in England and they drank a lot of it. So I guess that's kind of started the Australia thought process. I didn't do very well at school. I loved playing soccer and played to a high level and ended up not making it at the top end. So my dad was living in a pub. I started working in it. But I actually first started off wanting to be the youngest publican I knew, but I was still 16, so I had to go. So I couldn't drink, let alone serve it, which is something I've been doing since I was like 10 years old, working behind the bars. That's a different and long story. But the short thing was I had to start culinary college. I ended up my amazing tutor, John Stevenson. I hated cooking at the start, but pushed me to go and work down at where his son was the sous chef in a little hotel outside of London. And I was supposed to be there for 2 weeks, just over Easter. And the old bugger, I was supposed to be put front of house and then 1 week kitchen, but he put me in the kitchen first and I just fell in love with it. So I moved from there and then from there up to Scotland. And from Scotland, I just needed a break. We were doing 6 days, big hours, bugger all pay. And I'd got a couple of different jobs around England and a job opportunity for Charlie Trotters in Chicago. And I decided that I was going to come out to Australia instead and just see how it went. And in 2000, just as soon as the Olympics have finished, I came out and I'm still here, never left. it was actually really fun. Like the career element, I was actually supposed to come out and work for Mr. Scott, Raymond Capaldi and Gary Megan at their place in Richmond, which, Georgie C worked at. There's quite a big alumni at work there. And anyway, I the day before I was supposed to fly out to Australia, to Melbourne, and like I had no idea what I was coming out for. Like I even bought a guide, right? And I was supposed to backpack for a week and then start work straight away. And I was like, yeah, it's fine. Anyway, a Scottish lad who I'd been working with, Craigie Jenkins, had come over to be the sous chef for Ray. Anyway, the day before I was about to fly out, he came back and goes, Matt, don't go and work for that. He's a madman. And I'm like, I'm 25,000 kilometers away from this new restaurant, a new job. And I just worked for a Scottish madman who 250 kilometers away. There's no way I was. So I ended up flying out Stopped off in Singapore, and then my first night, I stayed at Regis Hotel. I had like three nights booked in a hotel, which is, you know, it's not got a good stick at the moment with the old COVID. But in 2000, and I went into the bar that night and hit it off with the barman and actually the bar lady. She ended up my first girlfriend. And was like, next thing I know, I'm working behind the bar and then working at upstairs at Bobby McGee's, which is the back then was Monday nights was hospo night, and actually Tuesday night was nurses night, which was actually better. And I was making Maduri illusion shakers, which I've got to say is something at Four Pillars we always end up drinking is Maduri. It's the second best drink in the world after Four Pillars gin.
Well, in the UK, you were working at Michelin star restaurants, and then you're doing Maduri cocktails. When did you first find your foot in the door in a kitchen in Australia?
So I decided I was going to backpack, and actually after one of these nights, I ended up buying a 180B Datsun for $50 out of an Essendon nightclub, and we set off to Sydney. And anyway, I got this 180B Datsun to Sydney, left it in Bondi, ran out of money, and then had enough money for the old bus back to Sydney. I'd had my 21st birthday in Sydney, and gone, oh, I've actually did a runner from the hostel, and got back to Melbourne, and I really needed a job. And when I first came to Melbourne, I bought the Good Food Guide. It was the 2001. And I made a top 10 list of all the places I wanted to go and work at. And you know, throughout that, the top of the list was back then was Donovan Cook and Philippa Sibley, at Estes, and their book had been out, and I'd seen that in England. And I know Donovan was from, I've actually just told him a story about a year ago, and he was laughing his head off. He's from Leeds, from Yorkshire, where I'm from. And anyway, I went there first. And it was back in, you know, South Melbourne. Anyway, it was locked to the front. This was like January the 2nd, and they were on holidays. But January the 6th, actually, 2001. And I went out the back and I'm looking. Donovan's there, and he politely told me to fuck off and come back tomorrow. I'm like, oh, grumpy bastard, grumpy Yorkshire bastard. Anyway, then I wanted to work at. The next on the list was Philippe Michel at the Brasserie. He was at Langton's then. And that, unfortunately, they were in the middle of service, so I was like, I'm not going to go in. So I headed to Toofies because I wanted to learn about Australian seafood. That was on my list. And Michael Bakash just finished service and is like, look, you're English, you can only work for me for 3 months. Can't do anything. So then I was like, I went, my mate who I'd met, Mark Prothero, hospitality guru, was at, what was the Italian cafe in Melbourne called? On Drummond Street, Faraday Street. Anyway, I was having a coffee with him there, and across the road was Vue de Monde. And that was like number 8 on my list. And Mark's like, just go and say hello to Shannon. He worked for, you know, Burn Race and Marco. And I'm like, oh, great. So I walked across there and walked in, and Shannon was actually making this terrine, a foie gras, lentil and ox tongue terrine that I'd made many a time. And I spoke to him, and he'd worked for Burn Race. So my two head chefs at the different places in England and Scotland had both worked for Burn Race, and then one had worked for Albert Roux, and the other one worked for Marco. And lo and behold, like, Shannon knew of them. And I got the job and started there the next day.
Wow. that was when it was in Carlton, in the original location. What was it like in the early days there in that kitchen?
Oh, it was, I must admit, I loved it. Like, we went through a lot. I think where I was there for 3 years. I think when I left, I was like – staff member 174 in
wow.
In the period. Like Shannon knew how to churn and burn. People just not rocking up, but it was just like a European kitchen to me. It was long hours, hard work, you know, a bit fiery. Shannon knew how to give a good bollocking. And you know, he made me junior sous and then sous, and then I left there in 2004.
And you took on your first head chef role and received a hat not long after that. What was that like, that period, having only been in the country for a couple of years?
Well, I think it was that one thing of realising the great thing that about Vue du Monde was just the clientele base. There were, you know, there was a group of people, like, you know, Shannon really heroed wine. It's something that I must congratulate him on. It's something that I've always taken on the rest of my career, that, you know, wine's a really important part of the restaurant scene and just life. So opening it up, a lot of those same customers came, and but I was way too young to be. I was 24, a head chef. I didn't know anything really about life. I didn't know anything about business. I knew I had to do costings and that, but not how to run a kitchen. And you know, I was only there 18 months, the owner of it, and let's just say I don't see eye to eye with him. A bit of a classic dodgy hospitality owner. He loved the anyway. So I left there. He sacked one of my best mates who was running the restaurant, and I was up in bloody, where was I? I was up in Port Douglas, and I'm like, man, I'm not coming back. No, like, get stuff. Like, no way, you're an idiot. Anyway, I actually spoke to John Letterlane about it, because I was sponsored and I needed sponsorship to stay in the country. And the person who's one of my biggest heroes and, an amazing human, Andrew McConnell, called me up and see if I wanted to come on board to be the sous chef then it was Circa the Prince. He just got given three chef's hats, and I think he won chef of the year and the restaurant of the year. And I came on board there, and so the head chef was David Moyle, I was the sous chef, and Andrew was the executive. And that was kind of like a platform of learning and hospitality, and what true the Van Handels, both John and Frank separately, but also together, and their GM, Roseanne, sorry, Highland, just amazing hospitality people, and that was that real eye opener, and that's, I guess, when my learning really started.
Tell us about the food that you were cooking in that kitchen with that team, because it's such an amazing alumni have come out of that period of time.
Yeah, well, there was John JP, so John Paul Toomey. There was Chris Watson, Josh Murphy. Like, there was Philippa Sibley in the bloody pastry kitchen. There was an amazing thing, and it was actually, I must admit, it was a really interesting side, because I'd known and I'd always loved Andrew's food from the 2-on-1 days, but that was that element of, you know, 2-on-1, like most restaurants of that time, was small, and there wasn't that many bigger kitchens and restaurants. So there was 17 in the team, and we were doing fine dining food, 3-out food for 120 covers, and that wasn't, you know, that was more of a key or a so it was actually really hard. And the great thing that I loved about Andrew was that he was always open, and his one thing was always about surrounding himself by really amazing cooks and people, and that is that your life gets easier and you can all, you know, move forward and get better. And the food, but it was my first day there was like, I'd been working during the day, and I got there at 3 o'clock, and Andrew goes, oh, there's the section. And I'm like, you want me to do a section? And I was like, yeah. So they gave me the hot section, and I still had to, I'm like, says, what's prep's been done? How many's booked? And it's like, oh, it's like a Thursday night. There was 90 booked. I'm like, has anyone prepped it? I'm like, no. So Morley and JP's giving me, like, JP was on the hot entree, and he's like, oh, mate, you've got a fucking lot to do, hey, mate. And I'm like, okay, never been in this kitchen. And, like, the hot section at Circa at that point cooked everything. So it was all, you had to do all meat, all sauces, all preparation for garnishes, plus then functions, plus Dego. And the Dego menu was completely different to the a la carte. And the a la carte was four or five meats. And then there was like three or four meats on the entree. It was anyway, and that was just a massive eye-opener of how high-end, top-end food you do fine dining and with big numbers.
Well, you had a baptism of fire when you started there, but you ended up in the role of head chef. What was it like working with Andrew and being head chef of a restaurant and being a bit more mature than your previous role of head chef?
Well, I think that's where I think every chef goes through in their career. And at some point, you just figure out who you are as an actual chef and what you actually like cooking. So in quite quickly, I started there 2005. By 2006, we kept three hats. 2007, Andrew kind of departed and became consultant, and they made me a Moily joint head chef. That was in late 2006. And into 2007. And then John Van Handel bought the Beach Hotel and Moily moved up there. So I was on my own running a brigade. And, you know, a lot of the staff that were there and then were like Moily's humans. They weren't mine. So I had to really rebuild. And there's a lot of complicated, you know, 7 days a week, lots of other food options as well. So it was a massive steep learning curve. And I must admit, it was probably the hardest and biggest challenge mentally and physically ever. I was quite angry. I'd taken on some of the traits of my former head chefs to get my point across and asking for food quite quickly, but ended up with an amazing team. But it was around 2008. Well, it was 2008. I just wasn't happy. I realized mentally I wanted to go to this. The food that I was cooking was the format of what Andrew's food was. People expecting this sort of food, and it's just not how I could naturally cook. Even though I'd been trained in fine dining, I'd started. All the books I've been, you know, I'd been buying the El Bulli books and all the books of the time, you know, the Calandras, the fine dining books of the world, the 2-3 Michelin star guys. And I just realized that the books I actually enjoyed reading were Stephanie Alexander's Cook's Companion and The River Cafe and Darina Allen's, you know, the cooking, you know, lessons in cooking, and Alistair Little, Simon Hopkinson. And I really struggled of what my food was and how I cook. And it just didn't I feel like everything I was doing was pushing and straining to do something fine dining. Like, I can remember doing this potato coil, and it took fucking hours to make them. And we need to do like 40 a day. And I'm just looking, and then it was filled with foie gras, like this foie gras mousse, and with this roasted quail and quail spice. And I'm like, is it food? Is it not? And it was at this time where I met now Charlie, my wife, who was at the Melbourne Food and Wine Festival. And I went to the Van Handels and said, look, I'm just not happy. Like, this is not the food I want to cook. The journey I want to go on is I've lost complete disconnect. I want to get back to it. And they said, well, what do you want to do? I thought, I just want to cook real simple food that's direct from the producer. And that's where it came from. I had to look at who I was as a human. Like, my grandfather was a very simple, beautiful human being who loved a whiskey and bread and dripping and grew all his veggies. I was a coal miner, hard working coal miner. And I looked at these things and I looked at what is truly seasonal. And to me, it was only vegetables and fruit. And that's where I decided to simplicity of cooking, of just letting the flavors come through of, and the amazing producers that we have in the world, and especially in Victoria, using them and getting a connection between them. And food writer Richard Cornish was a real mentor through that, about connecting connecting with people. I do a lot of road trips with him, meeting suppliers. And just out of it, I felt this confidence, and I decided that instead of Australia, you know, I'm always going to be a foreigner. I've got this stupid Yorkshire accent. I go back to the pub in bloody Yorkshire, and every bugger's like, "What's that stupid Aussie accent you've got?" And I'm like, they call me a fucking like surfer, and I'm like, I'm fucking like. And then I come here, and everyone's like, "Why are you so English?" I'm like, "Fuck, fuck." Anyway, so it's quite funny in that way where I decided that, you know, and this is pre-kids, that Australia is home, but more importantly, Victoria is my home. And I think coming out of this pandemic, it shows so much more, like with Federation, and that I'm like, oh fuck, I was right. Like, I backed that. If anything was to be truly seasonal, you have to work within the surrounds of you. And there was all that, you know, Paul Mathis had that 100 miles or 1,000 K restaurant, and I'm like, I wasn't going for that. I just wanted that seasonal produce that was, and working direct with the farmer, you just knew more about the produce than anything else. And that was that journey that I started, and I was very fortunate with the Van Handels that they backed me on that, and we changed the restaurant to show that. And you know, I thought I was going to go down to, I just thought I was going to lose all the hats. I'd already bloody lost. And that's the most gutting feeling. From Andrew leaving, we went from 3 hats to 2 hats. And I thought I was going, like, in fact, even bloody Andrew told me I was going to lose another hat, and I was going down to 1 hat. And I can remember being at the Age Good Food Guide Awards, and Roseanne Highlands next to me. I am like shaking, and like I look like I'm like about to faint. And they're reading out all the 1 hat restaurants. And this is 2008. And we hadn't. We'd kept 2 hats. In fact, we'd actually gone up 0.5 of a fucking score. And Andrew sat in front of me and turned around and gone, "Sorry." I'm like, "Fucking you bastard." Anyway, the we redesigned Circa. And at that point, I'd been working. Sorry there, bro. Yeah. So I'd been working on. I've been working on quite a bit with gardening, and we'd had our own plot in South Melbourne, and then working really directly, and I ushered in this area of that farm to table on 2009 into 2010 at Circa, and loved it. And I just felt, as soon as we started that menu, it was just so easy to write and so easy to cook it. And learning the techniques of how to cook into that simple way was just amazing.
Well, that change to be able to cook the way that you felt more natural cooking that led to Pope Joan, a very influential cafe that epitomized that kind of locally grown seasonal fare. Tell us about Pope Joan.
Yeah, so Pope Joan was like, so my mate Benny Foster, my girlfriend at the time, he worked with her, and I had some spare money, which I should have put into a house. Just anyone that's listening that's young and thinks about owning a restaurant before buying a house, just think again. Just put that money into a house, or use someone else's money. Please. It was supposed to be just a cafe that I had on the side. And I wanted to like open a restaurant. I actually looked at a few spaces, and I wanted to call it Hen and Cock and be this kind of like British bar, kind of like Movida, but with like, you know, my influences of Britain. I never ended up getting it off the ground. But then my focus before that was Pope, and I was actually still at Circa for 3 months whilst I opened up Pope Joan, and I did a 3 month straight. So I was doing like breakfast at Pope, then going for the nighttime service, and then after Saturday night service, I'd go and do Sunday. So I'd have like Sunday night off, really, and that was the only Sunday night and Monday night I'd have off. And it just broke me. I got too tired. But the one thing that both Ben and I wanted from Pope Joan was we didn't want it to be the high end of coffee. We didn't want it to be the high end of food. We wanted it just to be like Ian Botham, like the best all rounder. You know, a bit fun. And I really wanted to, there was amazing cafes in Melbourne already, coffee, food. I just wanted to do something I wanted to show that you can take high end refined dining, like high-end bistro food, like we were doing at Circa, almost fine dining, but with singular thought process of ingredients and put it in. Proudest and hardest thing I've ever done was Pope Joan. And in the end, developers got the space back. You know, it was a lot of bloodshed and tears, but it's also during the end of... So we owned Pope Joan for an end 8 years. And I think through that 8 year cycle and that cycle of life that you come in and out of thought processes, that I went through two cycles of my own life within Pope. So yeah, so the developers got the land, and I'd been like fine with them to try and get some money, some bits and pieces. I'd made some bad business decisions and ended up in a bit of debt that I needed to get out of. But the last 6 weeks of cooking there, like I'd been testing these things out, summer camp cookouts, which was just one big fire out the back of Pope, and we ran it just through summer, and it was a lesson definitely in how not to do barbecues at times. Like the first one, I went and chopped up all my own wood from, well, it was actually Statey from Warry Alder Belted Galloway, brought down a truckload of mountain ash wood, which is really bad for barbecues, and just smoked the whole area out. But it was such a fun event, and my head chef at the time, Jakey, and my front of house manager Jimmy, we just worked on the menu. At the end of that week, we just write down what we wanted to cook, and it was literally, we wrote what we wanted to drink and eat, and then that was it. So it was this real love and refoundation of what hospitality truly is, and it's that element of looking after people and giving. And then it all ended, and it was, I decided to take 6 months off, and that's when I started with Four Pillars. I'd come up with a business idea about reutilizing food waste into smoking pellets and salts and sugars and stuff. And I'd been doing a lot of cooking for Four Pillars anyway, and they were friends. And I'd asked Stu if he was interested in hearing my business proposal. And he went, all right, tell me it. And anyway, I start with gin. he's like, well, we don't want all the other crap, Matt. We want the gin part and you. And I came on board, and they... to look at all of Four Pillars' basal waste and the food side of it, and just coming up with good ideas that are fun within that's not gin. And it's been that sped from, you know, making soaps, which was a really bad idea, which Cam McKenzie, if you do listen to this, I'm sorry. he said it was okay to sample some, and I ended up with 4,000 soaps on a rope. So I thought it was a fun idea. I think they're still selling them, but I came up with some ham glaze, and the best two I think what we've come up with so far is the gin salt made by Olsen's, which is the byproduct of making the rare dry gin and mixing it with their macrobiotic grey salt, and then with Gormo, the great Nicholas Gorman from Yarra Valley Caviar, who is a legend in himself as a producer, him and his partners, with what they do there with the hand harvesting. But during the last lockdown, Gorman and I were talking, I was able to go up and we tested about 36 times to get to this bloody Shiraz gin flavoured caviar, which is, it's actually really amazing. And we tried smoking the caviar with the gin pellets that I'd got and made, and we've ended up with this amazing product. So that was like one of the highlights, and it's one of the things, like being part of a different company, and after owning my own business for 8 years and then seeing the three co-founders that still run the business, Stu, Matt and Cam, I've learned so much for in the last 3 years. They've been amazing humans to be around, and watching that business grow, you know, 50% have got acquired, but they still own 50% of it. It's just a really amazing business of how good humans are and small businesses.
How different is the 25-year-old Matt Wilkinson compared to the chef that we see today?
So I think obviously we had a year out, coronavirus, but prior to that, I actually reopened Pope Joan in the city and then sold that as a brand, and it was great to see the end of that. I then took over and went into business with Maid Establishment, George and his partners, and Crofter, and turned that over. And I'd had an idea about what I wanted to do with food. And I realized from this time, this separation, having kids, being married, to then taking over Montalto, where I've completely taken a different process. I'm a lot calmer. The way I'm looking at Montalto is it's back to that thing, that first thing that I learned from Andrew. It's about surrounding myself with as many like-minded good people and trying to educate them through food of the different cuisines of the world, and that there's not just one, there's not a right or wrong way. The only wrong way is if it's burnt or it's off. And just working together as a team. I actually look back at myself when I was at 24, 26. I was like, and the Ian Curlers and the Paul Wilsons looking, you know, they were that bit older than the people that I looked up to. And just, and it's something I see now in young chefs. And I was there once myself. It's like the very ambitious, very outspoken, don't really know much about food. And that's something I think in the last 10 years I've really endeavored to know about, is how something's grown and the history of it. And why. And that respect for it. And I just didn't have it when I was younger. And I think that's led me to be more confident now with who I am and what the food I want to cook is. And so it takes away of like using that then team and asking for everyone's voice rather than just trying to be out on your own, which I was when I was young. And I think that those frustrations, the anger that people get out, it is your own ego, but it's just frustration that you can't deliver on who you actually really want to be. And that's what I found now at Montalto. It's such a, because we've got the 4 acres of produce there, I feel like I've actually found where I am and where I should be.
Wow.
Julie Belling, the gardener, it's like everything that I started back at the Circa days, I've gone the long way and different ways and through different avenues and seen so many different sides of food along my journey. But where Montalto's at is it's a special place for real true seasonality and growing. And now my job's there now is just slowly keep working on, you know, working with smaller producers, and that's to me is where I think I'm better. And I don't have the legs anymore. And I am definitely a lot fatter than when I first started, but I'm still good looking. But cool. It's the mental stage of my career, I couldn't be happier.
Well, as someone who's come from another country and made a real success of your career in hospitality, like many come to Australia and do that, what do you think about all the different countries, the representations in Australia and the makeup of Australian cuisine?
Yeah, I guess it's the thing that I've been playing around with the last couple of years in my head, and real frustrations of the true love of food and the understanding of origin. The true love of food and the understanding of origin. The biggest frustration I have is, and this is food writers, but it's also the growing of food, and because we can travel so much more now, is we've stopped regionalizing food and the origin of elements of it. So we call Italian food Italian when the food of Puglia is completely different to that of Veneto or to Piedmont. Parisian cooking is very different to that of provincial French. What you're going to get on the old Portuguese Algarve, know what I mean, is like very different to the street food of Porto. But we call it Portuguese food, and we think then straight away, you know, certain spices. We think Spanish, we call it Spanish food, we call it Chinese food. Like the Chinese, the Ulgar, that Silk Road, cumin, northern Chinese food is completely different to the pork and the roast duck of Hong Kong. And it frustrates me when, you know, especially supermarkets and shows, and we go, oh, amazing Italian food. And it's like, well, you know, I'll say especially Italian food because I do have a love for it, is the things that you get in Emilia and Romagna is very different to the things that you're then going to get in Sicily. and this regionality, and that's, we just put things together. And I think, I hope that we start to go, when we're talking about, and Melbourne and Australia, Melbourne and Sydney and Brisbane, and well, all of Australia is so multicultural, but we're pigeonholing it, and I don't think that's quite right. I was in a Ethiopian restaurant the other day, and I'm talking about a certain food, and they're like, no, you're thinking of Eurythian. It's like a different bread. And I'm like, oh, sorry. But it's that simplicity of pigeonholing that I really hope that will be a change. And it's something that we could lead in Australia, this same conversation about talking about our own origin of food, of what is Australian cooking and native ingredients, that we include the multicultural aspect of food into its own region and why it was there. Because you go around, I don't know if you've ever been around Sicily, you know, the three major cities are all very different food from one to the other, you know?
Yeah.
The north part, and it is one not a small island, but it's because certain inhabitants of certain time through history have brought that food there, and it's stayed, and there's a little bit of peasant element to the hills that you just don't get in the seaside element. And that's one thing. There's a few books out there that talk about it in those ways about true regionality. But it's only, I think it's also just coming out of COVID and talking to people about, oh, I miss going overseas for this. It's like, well, do you really miss the country? Because I've been to, there's some shitholes in England, right? Right? But going to the York Moors, I took my kids there in 2019 to Whitby and to, we went fossil hunting. And I went to Whitby and I was like, the food in England's amazing. Yes, there's this amazing fish and chip shop, but I've gone and bought the most beautiful haddock and samphire and these Welsh onions and beautiful English spinach from these little growers. I'm like, that is kind of that regional, you know, there is regionality in England, you know, there's a different sausage for every county. That's regionality. So that's hopefully something that, and that's something that I'm really interested in and wanting to just talk about a lot more now when I talk about and think about food.
Well, I think we might have to catch up with you again and dive deep into that topic, because it's absolutely fascinating and something that needs to be explored. Yeah. Matt, we've loved having you on Deep in the Weeds today. I think we definitely need to catch up in the not too distant future and dive deep again. Please keep in touch, and we'd love to have you on again soon.
Will do, mate. Thank you so much.
This is the Deep in the Weeds podcast. I'm Anthony Huckstep. Stay tuned as we share the stories of Australia's HOSPO community, suppliers and producers in search of hope during this pandemic. Special thanks to executive producer Rob Locke for making this all happen. Follow us on Instagram at Deep in the Weeds Podcast, or email us at podcast@deepintheweeds.com.au. Stay safe and be well.